Thank you. Thank you for having me, and you can never be too Jewish.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish radio show and podcast with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This week, Rabbi Sam talks with cantor Carl Sayers about a fascinating musical connection, how Leonard Bernstein drew on the traditional musical modes of Slekot when creating the music of West Side Story. So beneath the Sharks, the Jets, Tony, and Maria, there may be echoes of something much older, Jewish melodies that had been around for centuries. Cantor Carl Sayers joins us to show us where to listen for them. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. As we continue experiencing this last month of the Jewish year, Elul, and prepare for the coming holiday season, I'm always reminded of one of the favorite High Holy Days comments I have ever received. It was about the music that we do on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. A congregant approached me and said, "Rabbi, why is the music I hear at Temple always the same?" And I answered, "It's because you only come once a year on Yom Kippur. It's always Kol Nidre to you. Try coming Friday night and you'll hear something different." Now, the stereotype of the 2 or 3 day a year Jew, that is, somebody who attends synagogue only on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the Jewish New Year and the Day of Atonement, is a legitimate one. There's a reason our Jewish congregation needs lots more seats and prayer books on the High Holy Days, and that we expand our sanctuaries into the social hall and add additional services for different segments of our congregations. It's because Jews always have felt more strongly called to come and pray during the 10 days of repentance than at any other time of year. Now, that's a good thing, really. It's not the fun holidays of Hanukkah or Purim or even Sukkot that attract the biggest crowds. No, it's the time when we atone for our sins, apologize for our misdeeds, and seek to become better people in the new year. Still, it used to amaze me. I'd see people I hadn't seen quite literally for 12 months at Rosh Hashanah, again 10 days later at Yom Kippur, and then not again until we were all a year older. I, of course, was at the temple every Shabbat and during the week, too. They were the ones who came just once or twice a year. Mind you, these fine folks were paying members of our congregation. A few even participated in committees or helped significantly in some other capacity. But as far as attending shul to actually pray in community, that was reserved for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Or maybe just one of those days. I'm told that the same extremely limited observance phenomenon exists commonly in Christian churches. The people that do it are called CEOs, Christmas, Easter-only Christians. I bet there are Rams, Ramadan-only Muslims, and BBBs, Buddha's Birthday Buddhists, and probably even DHs, Diwali Hindus. In our increasingly secular society, the super occasional worshiper has become more common than the regularly present synagogue, temple, church, or mosque attendee. Interestingly, about 15 years ago, I started to notice that even as my own congregation at the time continued to grow and multiply, attendance on the High Holy Days began to decline, slowly but steadily. That was a surprise. As my original congregation expanded in my early years here in Tucson from 400 family members to 500 members to 600 members to 700 members to 800 family memberships, the attendance at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur grew rapidly and then began to shrink. We went from filling our sanctuary and social hall fully and needing double services the evening of Kol Nidre to not quite filling the building, and then needing only one service at Kol Nidre, and that trend continued over my many years at that congregation. It was strange. Our membership numbers were very strong, but our actual attendance at the High Holy Days, the one time of year when you could always count on seeing everybody who belonged to the shul and lots of visitors besides, well, those numbers declined. My rabbinic colleagues around the country shared similar tales. Even in strong, growing congregations in growing areas, that automatic attendance at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur stopped being so automatic. Maybe it was sometime in the early 2000s, and it has remained at best semi-automatic, if you will, through today. After the COVID pandemic, a lot of folks who stopped coming on the Yomim Noraim, the Days of Awe, simply never came back. Nobody's quite sure what the reason is, and many rabbis have attempted to bring back our straying flocks with alternative services, new music, outdoor services, and so on, mostly without too much success. It's a funny thing. American Judaism is still quite vibrant and active, and Shabbat service attendance doesn't seem all that much different from what it used to be. My congregational Passover Seders at Beit Simcha remain large, as do our Hanukkah celebrations, and bar and bat mitzvahs always bring crowds of people in the door. You just can't assume that everybody will be there for the High Holy Days anymore. Now, mind you, our congregational attendance at Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is still much larger than during a regular Shabbat, of course. This year, Rosh Hashanah falls on Friday night and Saturday morning, so there's really no excuse not to attend, while Yom Kippur begins on a Sunday night, so again, zero reason not to be there. So why this strange drop-off in attendance? If I had to guess, I'd say that many people simply don't feel obligated to go to things they used to go to with regularity anymore, and that includes the Jewish High Holy Days. Well, perhaps we can reverse that trend this year. Because to tell you the truth, the Days of Awe services on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur are genuinely awesome. The best of the whole year. We have the finest and richest and best rehearsed music, the most important sermons, the most beautiful liturgy and teachings out of the whole complicated Jewish year, all over these 10 days. All designed to bring our people to a spiritual high that is hard to match over the following 11 and a half months, no matter how hard we try. By the way, you can join us in person at Congregation Beit Simcha here in Tucson, September 11th and 12th for Rosh Hashanah, September 20th and 21st for Yom Kippur. Just go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up to attend all services. We're also broadcasting on our Facebook page at Beit Simcha, and guests are always welcome. It all begins, by the way, a week from Saturday night with the beautiful, mystical late-night Slichot service, Saturday, September 5th at 8 p.m. So please, my friends, join us for the High Holy Days, for Slichot, and then especially for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And if you don't join us, go somewhere to a synagogue or temple near you, even if you haven't been there in, 12 months. To play us in this morning, from the music of the coming Days of Awe, here's Berosh Hashanah, sung by an old friend, cantor David Propis, with his daughter Dina. On Rosh Hashanah it's written, and on Yom Kippur it's sealed. Who shall live and who shall die? Who will be at peace and who disturbed? Who will have a good year and who maybe not? That was Berosh Hashanah for the coming High Holy Days, starting September 11th. Rosh Hashanah is 2 weeks from Friday night and Saturday, September 11th and 12th. Yom Kippur is 10 days afterwards, Sunday, September 20th, Monday, September 21st. And Slichot, which you'll hear much more about today on our show, is just a week from this Saturday night, September 5th. Join us at Beit Simcha this year. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest this morning will be cantor Carl Sayers, who will explain, sing, and play just how much the Jewish liturgical music of the Slichot service influenced composer Leonard Bernstein when he was writing the score of his greatest Broadway show, West Side Story. Meet cantor Sayers when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, cantor Carl Sayers, has quite an interesting career. He's here to talk about Leonard Bernstein and the Slichot modes, which seems entirely appropriate as we approach Rosh Hashanah. He spent a long career as a software engineer, but has worked extensively as a cantor and now is the spiritual leader of a congregation. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. So happy to be here with you.
Well, I have to admit, I did West Side Story in high school, and I've done Slichot for many years. So this is a really interesting and hopefully valuable experience for our audience, hearing about a Jewish composer who took inspiration for something that I don't believe he's ever been directly tied to. Tell us a little bit about how you began this exploration.
So this actually started for me 13 years ago. I was studying Israel Alter's score for the Slichot service.
Right.
And I'm singing certain phrases, and I'm thinking to myself, I've heard this before. Phrases like, Neherogim v'nishkatim, Neherogim v'nishkatim v'nipochim. And I'm thinking, I've heard this somewhere before, and I can't quite place it. Where? Yadadadidam, ba-ba-ba-bidam, ba-ba-ba-bidam. Ba-ba-ba-ba-dum, ba-ba-ba-ba-dum. I think, and then I realize it's this. Yadadadidam, ba-ba-ba-ba-dum. And the words, Neherogim, v'nishkatim, v'nitbachim, slain, slaughtered, and butchered. This is from a piyut called Ech Nitach Pelefanecha, how can we open our mouths before you? Which describes the destruction, it's the aftermath of the destruction of the Second Temple.
Right.
And we read this as the introduction to the 13 attributes of divine mercy. And I'm listening to this and thinking, wait a second, that is what this music is all about. Slain, slaughtered, this music is from the rumble scene.
The rumble scene in
the sharks.
I remember it very well. You know, you're rushing in, you're brandishing knives. Two people end up dead at the end of it. It's very, you know, extremely accurate. So that can't be accidental, can it?
Well, that's a great question. And what I know is that Leonard Bernstein grew up in a synagogue in Brookline, Massachusetts, and he credits his cantor for turning him on to music. So I don't know specifically what score his cantor was singing on Erev Slichot. But what I know is that the themes and the traditions that Israel Alter encoded in this score are things that our people have been singing and chanting for a very, very long time. And then I just got deeper and deeper into it. And I mean, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There is so much, and so much that's clearly purposeful on Leonard Bernstein's part. Leonard Bernstein builds as the core of the West Side Story score these three notes, which you recognize as the opening of the show and is used throughout the score, this. Well, that's a tekiah, and that's not an accident. That's very purposeful. This is well documented. I'm not seeing things here. And Leonard Bernstein used that tekiah as the basis for the score. And so many of the songs are built upon that. So you take this tekiah and you just invert, it's a triad, three notes, and you invert the triad, you put the bottom note on the top, and you get Maria.
I just met a girl named Maria.
And, right. And the same three notes derived from the tequila. You have the song Cool.
For Cool, right.
And you invert the chord again and you get could be, who knows. It's the exact same chord. It's the exact same three-note figure based on the tequila. And Leonard Bernstein called that the kernel of the score. And in that rumble scene, you hear shofar blasts all throughout it. Here's a shvarim, and here's a trua. And Riff is killed by Bernardo on the trua.
Boy, it's fantastic. We will talk much more with Cantor Carl Sayers about Leonard Bernstein and the modes of Slichot, and really Jewish modes, when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established nearly 8 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary always. Call 520-276-5675. Religious school is starting today for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Barn Bat Mitzvah program, Torah Tykes Experience, Confirmation, and Teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up, BeitSimchaTucson.org. The Jewish High Holy Days are almost upon us. Join us at Beit Simcha, where guests are most welcome. You do have to pre-register for security reasons. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to join for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Services are led by me, highly musically, with lots of wonderful musical help. Meaningful, powerful, it's the best time of year. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tykes program, our extensive adult education academy courses, and of course, Shabbat services, Friday night at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat, Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, always followed by a delicious Kiddush, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. And all of our services are on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimchaTucson. All of our extensive Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha Tucson. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review To Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
An interesting place, one of the larger islands in the Mediterranean, Corsica, which many of us have not thought about much. I know Napoleon Bonaparte came from there. That's about it. It's part of France, kind of. And apparently there has been a Jewish presence there for a very long time. And stunningly, during the Holocaust, virtually no Jews were deported, even though it was occupied by Mussolini's troops and then briefly by the Nazis. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I think there was only one deportation. And the reason this came up at all was there was recently a little article on Facebook about the synagogue in Corsica, which was intact. And the article claimed that no Jews were deported during the war. I think the fact is that there was one out of a sizable population, so virtually none. And, you know, a lot of questions arise. First of all, where is Corsica? So if you look west of the Italian peninsula, there are two pretty big islands, one sitting on top of each other. The northernmost of those two islands is Corsica. The southern one is Sardinia. And much further south than that, and not really west of mainland Italy so much as it's the football being kicked by the toe of the Italian boot, is Sicily. Three very sizable islands with strong Italian influence, except that one belongs to France. And it is a normal département. In fact, there might even be two départements there. There might be Upper Corsica and Lower Corsica. Just as a function of population and geography, it's a place that, you know, not a lot of roads were built. It's not terribly developed. It doesn't have much population density. I think it's probably less population density than any other part of European France. People live in isolation in villages in the mountains with strong traditions. And when I was serving at the U.S. Embassy in Paris, I had to make field trips all over the country to get to know the country better. And particularly Corsica was the home of one of the independence movements. There were terrorists at the time who would occasionally bomb department stores in mainland France to remind the French of their desire for independence and their refusal to be considered part of France. So it was the only place in European France where, before I went, I had to get permission from the Ministry of the Interior, which provided a security detail that followed me everywhere. I didn't feel particularly free when I was there.
Right.
But I also didn't feel endangered in any way. I thought the French were overreacting. But I think the last thing the French want is for a foreign diplomat to be attacked, captured, killed, whatever, by homegrown terrorists who don't recognize the authority of the French government. So I think the French would go to great lengths to prevent anything like that from happening. They didn't go so far as to forbid my trip. So I went, and silly me, at the time, it didn't even occur to me that there might have been a Jewish community there, which of course there should be, because the whole Mediterranean world had Jews, especially in port cities. And Corsica has a couple of ports. So, you know, logically, had I thought through it, I would have realized that there was probably a Jewish community and I could have visited this historic synagogue. Didn't do that. Did find that the Corsicans were hospitable once they got over the fact that I had a security detail assigned to me. There was a limit to how hospitable they could be. But it's fascinating. You know, every one of the major islands in the Mediterranean has its own history and doesn't really consider itself part of whatever country it actually belongs to. So Sicilians talk about traveling to Italy as if they're not part of Italy. People on Crete talk about mainland Greece as if it's another continent.
Yeah, they do. It's true.
And the same is very much true of Corsica, which you can get to either by ferry boat from, you know, the major southern French cities like Nice or Marseille or whatever,
right,
or by air. I flew directly from Paris.
Tom, let's talk about the Jewish community there next week. Fascinating place, and we will talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. The rabbi is opening his mail one morning. Taking a single sheet of paper from an envelope, he finds written on it one word, schmuck. At the next Shabbat service, the rabbi announces, I have known many people who have written letters and forgotten to sign their names, but this week I received a letter from someone who signed his name and forgot to write a letter. Well, you know, that was an old Jewish joke of the week, because who writes letters anymore? A special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world? And how long should we expect it to take? This week's portion of Ki Tavo gives us powerful commandments about how we must live in society. We are commanded to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, the stranger. We are to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and the homeless. We are to create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We are to understand that a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. We are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live up to this covenant, to uphold it, to cherish it, to make it our own. And we are told of the blessings that will be ours if we can do this, and the curses we'll bring on ourselves if we cannot. This breed, this covenant, was large and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hand to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. Probably they didn't always manage to give their full tithes, to make their pilgrimages to the temple, to declare gratitude for what they had. I'll bet there were times they did not provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live up to this standard, nonetheless made them better people and made Jewish society egalitarian and, generally speaking, ethical. And when they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, return to the right course. Positive societal change was never instantaneous. It was evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors and was codified as a practical framework for life by the rabbis of the Talmud. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. Persecution directed at some of the weakest members of our society, immigrants, people seeking asylum, young children, LGBTQ+ individuals and couples. That hostility is simply wrong. We have a responsibility as American Jews and as decent human beings to work to change this directly and publicly. When something isn't right, we need to speak up, to seek change. That is what the Torah teaches us in Ki Tavo. That is what God requires of us. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, cantor Carl Sayers, explores how the great Jewish composer Leonard Bernstein sampled the music of the Slichot service and its modes in creating his Broadway masterwork, West Side Story. Hear it, quite literally, when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
For the second time this year, Iran has named a wanted suspect in the 1994 terrorist bombing of the Amiya Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires to a top security role. A spokesman for the Islamic Republic's president, Masoud Pezeshkian, said last week that Mohsen Rezaei had resigned as an advisor to the supreme leader, Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei, still hasn't been seen, by the way, and would assume the role of secretary of Iran's powerful Supreme National Security Council. Rezaei is a former commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC. Rezaei is wanted by Argentina and subject to an Interpol red notice issued at Argentina's request over his role in the 1994 murderous attack, which killed 85 people and remains the deadliest terror attack in Argentina's history. Earlier this year, Ahmed Vahidi, another suspect in the Amiya case, and also the subject of an Interpol Red Notice, was appointed IRGC commander. In a landmark ruling, 2024, an Argentine court held Iran and its proxy in Lebanon, Hezbollah, responsible for the bombing, setting the stage for international legal action. In June of 2025, Argentina's federal judiciary ordered 10 Iranian and Lebanese suspects accused in connection with the deadly 1994 EMEA bombing to be tried in absentia. Rezaei and Vahidi were among them. In other news, in New York, police have charged Larry Montez, 46 years old of the Bronx, with hate crimes. He attacked a congregant and a security guard at Manhattan's Central Synagogue during a Friday night Shabbat services about 10 days ago. Montez has been charged with 2 counts of assault as a hate crime and 1 count of criminal mischief as a hate crime, among other charges, Commissioner Jessica Tisch of the New York City Police Department said. Montez, who was arrested at the scene, disrupted Shabbat services before being apprehended by a security guard. As synagogue security was escorting him out, Tisch said, he struck a member of the congregation, damaged synagogue property, and then spit at and headbutted a member of the security team. Tisch, who grew up attending Central Synagogue, said that an NYPD sergeant working on a paid detail on site immediately stepped in and took the individual into custody. I've spoken to the rabbi of the synagogue. I'm relieved that no one was seriously injured, she said. While noting the investigation is still ongoing, Tisch said there are no other known threats at the moment. Additional NYPD resources have been deployed to Central Synagogue, a very popular place. For the police commissioner, however, the event was personal. She described the synagogue of her childhood as a place of comfort and peace, both in joy and sorrow. What happened there was deeply painful, Tisch added. A place of worship should never be a crime scene. The attack was caught on the synagogue's weekly live stream of its service. Clips from that live stream were widely circulated on social media news broadcasts. A loud popping noise was heard, followed by a woman exclaiming, "Oh my God," as Montez was escorted from the sanctuary. New York City Mayor Zoran Mamdani wrote he was horrified by the assault. I can only imagine the pain and fear an attack like this during Shabbat services causes for the congregation and for Jewish New Yorkers across our city. Mamdani emphasized that every New Yorker should be able to practice religion without fearing violence, describing the event as a despicable act that has no place in our city. Our administration will do everything in our power to keep Jewish New Yorkers safe, Mamdani added. Mamdani, however, has stirred anxiety among many New York City Jews over his criticism of Israel following the October 7, 2023 attacks and during the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. This attack comes less than a week after a group of rabbis met with the mayor to express concern about Mamdani's horrific anti-Israel rhetoric and its potential effect on the safety of New York Jews. And the ugliness in American politics and the open anti-Semitism seems to get only worse. In Florida, Jewish far-right firebrand Representative Randy Fine won a landslide victory in his GOP primary, ending a race marked by anti-Semitic tropes, allusions to Adolf Hitler, and sharp criticism of Islam. Fine secured 57% of the vote, a resounding victory over his main opponent, influencer Dan Bilzerian, a virulent anti-Semite who received 18% of the votes. Fine, who is currently serving his first term in Congress, was endorsed by President Trump, the Republican Jewish Coalition, and AIPAC. However, he sparked anger in Congress on both sides of the aisle for some of his comments disparaging Muslims, including comparing them to dogs, and for saying Gazans should starve away until the Israeli hostages were released. Frankly, the Gazans never starved, but never mind. Bilzerian, an influencer who has consistently spread conspiracy theories about Jews, has previously said he wants to kill Israelis and described his opponent as a fat Jew. After Bilzerian declared his candidacy, the founder of TMZ asked the influencer if his usage of the phrase was anti-Semitic. In response, Bilzerian questioned whether remarks made by Fine earlier this year about how Muslims are lower than dogs was Islamophobic. District 6 understands the Jewish problem, Bilzerian posted on X just last week. He followed up the next day with a message that the Jew is scared. A recent Bilzerian campaign music video referenced Adolf Hitler positively, featuring the lyrics, "Should we revisit that Austrian painter's opinions?" Congressman Fein told Fox News that Bilzerian is an open Nazi who transported himself from Las Vegas to Florida in order to target me. This isn't an organic campaign. It's an organized pogrom against the Jews. Last week, also before the election, a Fein campaign sign was defaced with a swastika, an act condemned by the ADL and other Jewish groups. Fein accused Bilzerian supporters of having painted the swastika, a charge Bilzerian denied and labeled the most Jew move of all time. At least that scum lost his primary. A variety of Democratic socialists who openly wish to see Israel destroyed, however, have been nominated in elections in a wide variety of states across the U.S. Oy. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Cantor Carl Sayers, who is the spiritual leader of Congregation Agudas Israel, has had a variety of other cantorial positions, spent a long career as a software architect, co-founded four technology companies, a Jewish book publishing company, has a degree in physics from Brandeis, applied physics from Columbia. It's a shame you're not better educated. I'm sorry. And received his cantorial ordination from AJR, the Academy of Jewish Religion, just a year or two ago. We had a great beginning discussion about West Side Story, one of my favorite shows, partly because I got an award for it when I was in high school, big deal, but also because the music is so exceptional. You started to talk about the shofar blast, the kiyah, shvarim, trua, how they're utilized in the score, and that in a way, they're kind of that triad is kind of the core of all of everything that's going on in West Side Story. Including some of the rhythmic aspects. I never thought about like the trua as kind of the climax of that rumble scene, but you're right. Tell us more.
So that kernel of the score, those three notes, and that was what Bernstein called it, the kernel, is the foundation, in fact, of every song in the show. And there are academic papers you can get where they deconstruct the score and basically show how you can derive every part of it based on those three notes. But when I got deeper into it, I realized, well, those three notes have a direct relationship with the music of the Slichot service, and particularly something we call the Slicha mode, or more technically, the Ukrainian Dorian mode. And, you know, it takes something like El Horet Ulanomar Shalosh Esrei, which is just minor, and then Zacholanu Hayom Rit Shalosh Esrei Zachola Maria. It's the exact same thing. And what's interesting about the Slicha mode and the way it gets used in the Slichot service, most of the service, like on the High Holidays, is chanted in a minor mode. But then there'll be a certain word that gets this raised forth, this tritone, which is what that shofar blast is based upon. And that tritone always resolves to the perfect fifth. Now that's again, Maria, Zecholanu Hayom Brit Shalosh Esrei. So that prayer, that's telling the story of Moses begging God to forgive the Israelites after the sin of the golden calf. And God appears to Moshe, this is a midrash, God appears to Moshe as a cantor, a chazan, wrapped in a white talit. And he teaches Moshe the Shlosh Esrei Midot HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of divine mercy. And that's what that passage is recalling. El Horet Olam Lamar Shlosh Esrei, God, you taught us how to say 13. That's just telling the story. But here's the bakasha, here's the request. Zecholanu Hayom Brit Shalosh Esrei. Remember us today with those 13 attributes. And we sing this, and on the key moment in the phrase is where we add that tritone, the raised fourth that makes this, that's the raised fourth, resolving to the perfect fifth. And my interpretation of this is that we have a penitence mode, a penitence motive here. That starting on the raised fourth, resolving to the fifth, is a musical way of trying to do teshuvah. And of course, that's what Tony is doing. Maria, I've just met a girl named Maria. And every time he says the word Maria, he's using this penitence motive. The same Zecholanu Hayom, the same remember us today. He's singing Maria, Maria. And then the words, you know, I think people probably misunderstand this song. This isn't a song about a girl. If you read the words carefully, the girl is barely mentioned in the song. And that might surprise you until I point out he's not singing about the girl. He's singing about a name, Maria. I've just met a girl named Maria. And suddenly that name, not the girl, will never be the same to me. This is about what that name means to him. Maria, I've just kissed a girl named Maria. Wait a second. A few months ago, I would have kissed Susan, and I would have kissed Sally, but I would never have kissed a girl whose name was Maria. What's happened to me? And suddenly I found not how wonderful a girl could be, he knew that. He's found how wonderful a sound can be, a sound that he would never have considered in his life. And every time he says the word Maria, he's doing an act of tshuva. Maria, say it loud, and there's music playing, and this is my favorite. This is my favorite musical moment in the whole show, and it might be yours too. Say it soft, and it's almost like praying. And you know, everyone hears this modally, something shifts right there. What is that? You know what? Here's our root. Maria. And then he goes, say it soft. 5, 6, lowered 7. 6, 5, 7, 6, 5. That lowered 7. Suddenly right. We've shifted to Adonai Malach mode.
Yeah.
It's Tefillah mode. This is the same thing we do on Kabbalat Shabbat.
Kabbalat Shabbat, right.
Shiru Adonai, Shir Chadash, Shiru Adonai. Say it soft and it's almost... He's moved into tefillah mode. On the words, say it's soft and it's almost like praying. Whoa. And then, and it ends, and he'll never stop saying Maria. He's not talking about the girl. He's saying, I've done tshuva, and I'm never going to go back. And that's the essence of the entire show. How do you do tshuva? And how do you make choices in your life that allow you to do tshuva? There's this line at the end of the song Somewhere. We'll find a new way of living. That's the best definition of tshuva I've ever heard.
And we'll find a way of forgiving, of course, yeah. Because forgiveness at the heart of tshuva.
You know, when you do tshuva, doing tshuva is much more than, you know, singing some songs in synagogue or beating your chest or even saying, you know, I'm sorry and I want to do better. Real tshuva comes when you made a change so fundamental in your life. Whatever it was that you've done in the past that you want to be different, you need to make a change so fundamental that you can never go back. In other words, find a new way of living. And that's Stephen Sondheim's brilliant lyric that just sums up everything about what Tony is trying to do.
You know, everybody thinks West Side Story is kind of a new version of Romeo and Juliet, which of course it is. And Romeo and Juliet are trying to resolve this ancient feud, right? Create a kind of tshuva between their families. And of course, it wouldn't be a good play if it ended happily, right? It has to be a tragedy. Almost all great theater is really tragic. And in this case, of course, it does end that way. Tell us a little bit about the way that Bernstein conveys that musically.
Bernstein changes Shakespeare's story in the most important way in terms of Slichot and Tshuva. You know, Romeo and Juliet is a story about chance events and misunderstandings. And the entire tragic ending is built upon that. Friar Lawrence is supposed to deliver a message that Juliet, she's not dead, she's just asleep.
She's just
in the
sleeping,
tomb.
Yeah.
But there's a plague, and he can't deliver the message. Oops. And the tragedy unfolds from that. And that's Shakespeare's entire point. Shakespeare's belief is that tragedy happens because of chance events and misunderstandings. But the entire point of West Side Story is that tragedy is caused by the choices that people make. So consider the ending. Anita finds out about Tony and Maria, and she says to Maria, a boy like that who'd kill your brother. And Maria convinces her, no, 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 Anita, I have a love, and that love is different than what you and Bernardo had. And she convinces Anita to help her. And right there, can you imagine that? Anita's lover was just murdered an hour earlier than this. And she convinces Anita to help her. And Anita goes to the drugstore. And she tries to tell the Jets, I'm here to help. I have a message for Tony. but they're so overcome by their hate, and they grab her, and they almost rape her, until Doc stops it, and she gets up, and she's so disgusted, and she says to them, she makes a choice here. She says, when Chino found out about Tony Maria, he killed her. There's no accidents. There's no misunderstandings. She made a choice. That choice gets down to Tony. Overcome with grief, he runs out into the street, and that's how the tragedy unfolds. There's nothing chance here. Everything was purposeful, and everything was based on the choices that people made.
Which is incredibly Jewish, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really what the High Holy Days are all about. Slichot begins that process most intensely, but it's our choices to be good or bad. It's our choice to follow mitzvot or to violate them. It's our choice to do tshuva or remain as we were. And it's fascinating. And, you know, Bernstein didn't write the book, right? But he certainly had huge influence over the guys who did. You know, I was thinking about the lyrics a little bit because you showed the interplay there. Those lyrics are Sondheim's lyrics, right?
A combination of Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence. Yeah,
Arthur Lawrence, too, right. All Jewish.
Yes, all four of them. Jerome Robbins, too.
Jerome Robbins, of course. And the movement, of course, is, although I would say, I don't think that the Jerome Robbins choreography exactly fits with, say, what we would expect from Fiddler on the Roof, let's say. But in dramatizing the power of those modes, which, as you've, I think, shown quite beautifully, are Slichot modes, they're taking that theme and creating it in every artistic way. What is your kind of favorite trick that Bernstein did in integrating this from the show? And I shouldn't say trick. It's a modality he's used, a variety of modalities, but it's a way that he's incorporating this.
I think Bernstein is intimately familiar with the music of the synagogue. And, you know, one of the earliest questions you asked me was, you know, did Bernstein essentially do this on purpose? Is he thinking about Slichot when he's writing this? And I don't know the answer to that. But what I'm reasonably confident about is how much this music must have influenced him, and that it was there when he needed it, and that he could draw upon it. And, you know, an interesting thing about how it developed, you know, that this, it comes out in 1957, but the idea was suggested initially by Jerome Robbins, I think it was in about 8 years earlier, and it wasn't about Puerto Rican and Polish immigrants. It was about Jews and Catholics.
Jews, yeah.
The original idea was actually supposed to be a Jewish and Catholic struggle recreating the idea of Romeo and Juliet. And they were working on it, and they decided they just couldn't make it work, and they put it in a drawer. And then some years later, there was this rash of violence on the Lower West Side of Manhattan. And the idea came back, but this time it was recast as Polish and Puerto Rican immigrants. So my hunch is that a lot of this music actually was written earlier, intended for a musical that would have been about Jewish themes. So there's a reason for a shofar blast. There's a reason why all this Jewish music is actually hidden in it. But then Leonard Bernstein had an opportunity to use all these Latin rhythms that he loved in his music. So it worked out really well for him musically.
That's great. I want to thank Cantor Carl Serres for a delightful and fascinating visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about you or to find out more about these themes?
Well, actually, I'm going to be doing a whole presentation on this for the Cantor's Assembly on Thursday night, September 3rd, talking about this all of this material and going into a lot more detail. So I would love for you to join me. It'll be on Zoom, hosted by the Cantor's Assembly, and we can find a way to get you the link to that. I'm in Newburgh, New York, and we have a synagogue here, and it's a marvelous community. And I'd love to hear from you, and I'd love for you to visit us anytime.
Carl, thank you so much, and an early Shana Tova Matuka.
Shana Tova.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Two Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Joel Dinnerstein, author of the new book, The Last of the Ellis Island Jews. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night, Shabbat services, 6:30 p.m. with Onig Shabbat immediately afterwards. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org for services and class schedule. Sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership. Religious school starts today. And definitely join us at Beit Simcha for the High Holy Days. You can register as a guest on our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org. Come for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Join our beautiful musical services September 11th and 12th for Rosh Hashanah, September 20th and 21st for Yom Kippur. Slichot is just a week from Saturday night, September 5th at 8 p.m. at Beit Simcha. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from the coming High Holy Days music from the Slichot liturgy, Hatei. Look on us, God, and have compassion in our struggles at this time of forgiveness. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona. Asher Nigeroth.